Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guest tonight is Mike Bradner of the Alaska Legislative Digest. Mike is also a former speaker of the Alaska House of Representatives, and we're going to draw on his expertise in that category too. Mike, it's the slow season in politics. Until now, with the announcement out of the blue that Anchorage State Senator Hollis French is running for governor as a Democrat.
Well, I suspect his decision is influenced by the fact that Mr. Walker, has chosen to run as a third party candidate, as an independent, and there's a good deal of difference between a three-way race and a two-way race. He's certainly a capable individual. I mean, he's had a lot of time and grade. He's had his controversial elements. I mean, he's been a real champion of not doing away with the oil tax.
And the repeal of the Parnell tax.
And he went through a real tough election in, I think what everybody would admit is sort of a
gerrymandered district.
And raised a lot of money. So he's met some of the passing, you know, thresholds to jump into that race. Now, in a three-way race, he probably has an opportunity.
Now, what do you make of the talk that Senator Bill Willikowski, who is a colleague of French, and they've been aligned on many, many different issues, would run with Walker as an independent, and Willikowski, who's been talked about as a Democratic candidate for governor, would leave the party, or at least temporarily, to run on this, what, fusion ticket or something?
I guess you'd have to call it something of that nature. And if Hollis is on the other side, I don't think that works very well. But that's, I think, is a lot of speculative thinking. I'm not sure that he would do that. But you never know. I mean, when people have ambition, they're likely to step forward and do it. He was also tested at the polls last time around as a main target.
And he proved he was a definite vote getter and skilled.
Both probably in a head-on, they're pretty liberal and maybe too liberal for Alaska right now. But that doesn't carry in a three-way race. I think anything can happen.
The three-way race means if you can get 39 or 40% of the vote, there's a good chance you will be the winner because the other two candidates are real candidates who have their base. What I wondered about, Mike, is if Bill Willikowski does become the lieutenant governor and he serves with Walker should they win the election, where does that leave him? There are people who want him to be governor. They're not excited about him being lieutenant governor. And then what does he do under a Walker administration? You can't speak for him, but watching Juneau, what do you think?
Yeah, it is quite a separation. And I think if they were smart, they would find something for him to really do rather than isolate the individual, which has happened a lot of times where you just isolate the lieutenant governor and they're left guarding the state seal. Really, they run elections and they're waiting for the governor to have shortness of breath and somebody knock on their door and say, we have to swear you in. And of course, there's the situation with Sarah Palin and that.
She resigned. That was very unusual.
But it's happened. And Wally Hickel, where somebody succeeded the governorship. And I suspect if you think the cards are a little bit stacked against you and sort of the electoral balance of Republicans and Democrats, maybe you take that chance. I mean, that's
Or maybe you think I'm not going to get another chance.
That's right.
But presumably, Senator Willikowski, if he makes this run, will have lots of opportunity to explain it, not just to us, but to the viewing audience and all Alaskans. Mike, you recently took a tour of Bush, Alaska, or make that some of Bush, Alaska. You've lots of experience both in life in rural Alaska and in the politics of rural Alaska. What did you see on this particular trip? And first of all, let's start off with, where did you go and how long were you out there?
Well, it was a trip put together by the Village Council President's Association in Calista, and they were present during the whole trip. And we went to Bethel and then to Kasigaluk, Tuksuk Bay, Amonik, and then St. Mary's.
And there were other people along with you guides?
Generally, the senior staff assistants of Senator Murkowski's office. We had Don Young's chief of staff. They were the people who, and the state, Miles Baker, the Murkowski state director. So there were people that, they're there to help, you know, the elected official make the choices that they have to make. And I was impressed with, first of all, I guess at the get-go, our people who invited us, Calista, seemed to have an excellent hold on things. There seems to be a lot of cooperation between the agencies and the Delta now, and you have the hospital operation. It's huge. You have
that's in Bethel.
Yes, and it's run by the tribal organizations, and then you have two very active CDQs. That's the fisheries allocation of pollock, that they develop their own fisheries onshore and elsewhere, and they're doing very well, and they employ a lot of people.
So seasonally, I presume, when you say employee.
Seasonally, yes. And, of course, there's a lot of people out there who don't want to work. I mean, it's not in the culture to...
Or they work in the traditional manner.
That's right. And yeah. Certainly not during hunting season.
Yeah.
I mean, and so those organizations are almost parallel organizations with Calista. And they have a lot of plans in the works. But it's interesting to go. It's a changed world. I first went into that area in 1965, and the villages are dramatically different. And
tell us some of the ways they are different in your experience.
Well, I think I felt like they were very forthright at meetings. They stood up, they explained their budgets, they expressed their concerns very directly, and responded to questions very clearly, where I think, you know, 45 years ago, it would have been like, well, who are you and what are you doing here? They also knew the people involved, and they knew how important some of these contacts were for them. For instance, they knew what the word sequestration meant. And you walk around Anchorage and you ask that, say that word to people, and say, what are you talking about? Well, they knew exactly what kind of impact it could have on their budgets. And so there's a knowledgeability. There is a tendency, I think, for them to work through their organizations. I mean, they're
the very, native organizations, organizations.
That's right, and the city council and so on. You know, they don't necessarily act as individuals to express their will to the legislature.
And if I might, what's being sequestered or is on the verge of sequestration that they're worried about?
Well, there's a lot of BIA money and other, and that comes in, and like BIA road money. And they have a roads program that's active, and it's not roads in many cases like we think of it, but rather they have a process where they call their clusters. Like there's a cluster of villages that they can intertie in the mouth of the Yukon. There's a cluster of villages in and near Tuxuk Bay. There's several others. And they've connected like Tuxuk Bay, Nightmute, and Tununik, right in the middle of the Delta. They've hooked them together at a common power grid. AVAC, the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, has accomplished that. And that's another organization that works very closely with them and virtually covers every village in the Delta. But they're also doing these trails, these ATV highways, roads. And they're laying environmental mats, these mats you hook together you know, are perforated.
And how long would these trails be?
Well, they have about, I think it's 6 miles built from Nightmute towards Tununik, and it takes time to get them down. You have to, you know, find a good base for them to lay on. But the grasses grow up through the mats and really fix them to the ground. And when you look at, you know, our streets, what are we doing all the time? We see them ripping up the pavement, rolling up the top grade of asphalt because of grooves and having to redo it. Well, there's a simple, you know, a similar maintenance profile that they
and,
would have.
And before we move on from this discussion of your trip to Southwest Alaska, if there was one common theme in all these villages or that you heard, what was it?
Well, one is gravel in the lower delta. They desperately need to be able to secure sources of gravel in large enough quantities and not only get it to the village for existing projects, but leave a stockpile. And they don't have good gravel moving barges in the area. There's nobody who would facilitate saying, oh yeah, you're moving gravel for a specific job, that's paid for. But what about gravel that you would want to stockpile?
And because of the ground conditions they have, that's there, right. I'm presuming they don't have the gravel they need.
I mean, in Ammonic and the Delta, that's all mud. Yeah. And when it rains, it gets to be a mess. And they have erosion, and they need to get gravel in those banks to prevent erosion. And it's a universal problem. And it's one that's probably solvable.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Mike Bradner. Mike, the Idle-Metsu Ferry is on the front page again, front page of the Daily News, and it's the top of the other media outlets, too. Apparently, the Metsu Borough is weary of caring for this vessel, mothballing it, this $80 million vessel, at almost a price tag of $70,000 a month. How did the borough get into this mess, and how does it get out? We've had this on the show before as a topic, and it keeps coming back.
I don't know. Maybe you have to give it away. But I think it resulted from our tendency everywhere in Alaska to do map economics. You draw a line, and it looks like, oh, you know, that's logical. You know, let's do it. And you jump over very carefully testing the feasibility of what you want to do. Like,
and if I might, in this case, the money was available from Congress.
Yes.
So these didn't have to appropriate their own money at the beginning of this process.
So yeah, and that created that let's jump at it. Well, sort of like the railroad connection to the Fairbanks Anchorage International Airport. And as I understood the story, Stevens had the head of the Federal Railway Organization.
Senator Ted.
Yeah, in tow. And the guy had a fixation on these connections. And he saw the railroad tracks out there, and he said, what is that, you know? And so the tracks were already there, and it was just almost instantly he had the money, you know, so why not? And but the why not in the case of the Metsu was a liability in its use and maintaining the vessel. But it seems like they ought to be able to sell it someplace. But still, we have that tendency to draw the lines on the map. We draw a line to the West Coast years ago, and oh, we're going to have an LNG line. You go to the West Coast, there's the market. But you didn't draw the line from Alberta.
This is reminiscent to me of going to meetings and hearing speeches, talks, variety of different presentations on. Do you realize how much coal there is in Western Alaska? Do you realize how much natural gas there is in some other part of Alaska? That as if the resource itself is going to guarantee its successful development.
Well, there used to be a diesel topping plant at Prudhoe Bay, and when Al Adams was just elected from Northwest Alaska, and he asked me if I would do a quick study of fuel backhaul, where you would be hauled this back from Prudhoe Bay and deliver oil to the villages. And of course, just the literage costs alone was going to prohibit it. And I said, Al, you know the answer to that? And he said, yeah, I do. But every meeting that comes up and people just beat it to death and we can't get on to the next issue, I want something I can hand to them and say, we've looked at that, done that, and get on to the more realistic scenarios.
Let's get on to this. North Carolina just passed a pretty restrictive voter identification law, not only requiring voter ID at the polls, making it harder to register to vote and to register people to vote. This was done by the Republicans in Carolina in the measure of interest in, they say, preserving the integrity of the elections, preventing voter fraud. We've heard similar things up here, the challenge that there is voter fraud, and Representative Bob Lynn and others have pushed a bill that would make it harder for some people to vote and require different kinds of ID and a whole lot of things in that realm. What do you make of this discussion as it's applied to Alaska?
Well, I don't think it really applies up here. Out there, it's the motive sort of becomes clear. Old-time discrimination and stuff hasn't quite gone to bed. This time, it's wearing a more partisan cloak. Up here, we have a centralized voting system, and we haven't had a lot of controversy. We don't have a county system where local officials can get involved in discriminating against registration and so on. The question is, what fraud? I mean, we don't have any evidence, really, of voter fraud. And even in North Carolina, as I recall, that they did an analysis and they found out none of the accusations were true. You know, the graveyard didn't vote. And
although in history, there, if you read any biographies of Mayor Daley of Chicago, it's quite clear these things have happened in different places. But here, I think haven't they found usually it's been mistakes of people registered in two different places or two different states or no longer living here?
Or they've declared a residency elsewhere or something like that. But I don't think we've taken hardly any to, prosecution. Basically across the country, they've found has a lot of integrity that people just don't do that. And
you'd have to be highly organized to make much of a difference. If I vote twice, I know there have been elections that have been won by one vote, but in a statewide election, it's unlikely that my one vote is going to make that much of a difference. What really would make a difference if I could organize 150 people, and that gets pretty hard to do.
Yeah. Well, what also they could do is if you're concerned, you could have a rolling audit that doesn't audit the whole election, but it takes districts that were reasonably close, and every election, three or four, and you never know which, you do sort of an audit of the election process and inspect the votes. So that's sort of it.
By hand count is what we're talking about here, right?
Well, hand count and other means as if there were influences on the process. But the thing is, everybody makes these accusations before an election, but usually after an election, everybody's relieved and just wants to go to work. Nobody pays any attention.
Okay. Speaking of elections, former Representative Vic Coring of the Valley, Wasilla, who was accused and convicted of corruption and then had his conviction overturned, is a long story, and then pled guilty to time and served time for various misdeeds, is now back running for the Wasilla City Council. And I wonder, somebody given your experience in the legislature, how common is this for somebody who's somehow been disgraced to stay in politics and say, I'm going to make a comeback?
It's tough and very rare. And there's also something about the way you campaign, that you have a chip on your shoulders and that just doesn't sell well. Equally, it's tough for people to come back to a state often and run for office. Senator Murkowski in Alaska came back, ran for governor, but a lot of people said, well, his dialogue wasn't the kind that you are schooled in carrying on, on the local level. So it's very difficult to come back from one constituency to another. Now, Vic, I'm not sure why he's doing this. It seems like...
How about, this is all I really know. I liked being in the legislature. I want to be in the legislature, and... he's talked about. He's eating out of the creek, catching his dinner every other night.
Well, I think that's possibly the case. He was very responsive. You would call his staff just seeking some small piece of information, and half an hour later, here would be Vic on the phone. And you'd almost want to say, Vic, you probably don't have your hands on this amount of detail. I wanted to talk to the staff person.
Yeah.
But he enjoyed the job, but that's going to be up to the Mat-Su voters.
And isn't there some measure of maybe Valley voters want to be forgiving, but they might say, yeah, we'll forgive you, but why don't you go do something else?
That's right. And I don't know. It's going to be interesting how that turns out. I mean, the Mat-Su voters are pretty conservative, and I don't know what that means in this case, whether... They feel like, oh, well, you picked on our guy, so we're going to show you that we'll elect him.
Yeah, and Vic, in his public statements, former Representative Coring, one of the things he plays on is innocence by association. His view is Ted Stevens got a bad deal from prosecutors, and so did I. So yes. It's not guilt by association, it's innocence by association. And of course,
right.
It probably doesn't help to or hurt to link your name to someone as venerated and respected as Senator Stevens. Okay, Mike, an apparently drunken driver, Stacey Allen Graham, killed two teenage girls here a couple weeks ago. I guess it's 10 days ago at this point. This was a shock to the community, led the news outlets for days. What is to be done about drunken driving? And I'm thinking about it from the legislative perspective.
Well, we've
the legislature takes up these measures all the time. Excuse me.
A whole period where the legislature was increasingly restrictive and punitive. In recent years, there's been some indications like interlock ignition devices, so people who desperately needed the car to go to work or had could do so. So there had been some modification on that. Now, what that's going to do in this case, I don't know. This person appeared not to be a person who was, you know, an alcoholic or had an extremely bad record. But it's obviously, I mean, it's a very emotional situation, I think, with two 15-year-old girls being killed who were just walking along the street. So something's going to happen. Now, it would be interesting if they took a more sort of progressive route and said, we've built a culture that I think has very successfully weighed against people's personal conscience in terms of driving when they have alcohol. I think a lot of the kids today will go to the bars. They'll take cabs, or they'll go to the other people's houses. And what we haven't done is use perhaps the resources that we're using right now, good media, good production, to go beyond the public safety ads that we're just saying, well, you know, we're going to slap your hands, you can go to prison, you can do this. But show the result of what happens, to try to drive that political culture of you just don't do it. Take a cab.
It's interesting when you talk about the promotion of sobriety in the driver's seat. If you listen to Major League Baseball, you can hear former rock and roll stars coming on and saying, great music should live and so should you. Take a cab home, walk home, don't drive home.
When the DMV was on Dowling Road, they would allow families whose kids were involved in, you know, these tragic situations to put up these montages of pictures. And I remember one of them, a parent was saying, my daughter was supposed to be the designated driver and she wasn't. And people take, you know, the police take photos of all these accidents, and you wouldn't wonder that somebody to get a driver's license, they got to go in a media room and they have to see, you know, the result of you're driving around a loaded weapon in a way.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think we've got to go in that direction. What can you do to drive that consciousness deeper?
Okay, Mike, the Democratic Party files suit against the reapportionment board protesting the most recent reapportionment decisions. Democrats will have their day in court. What do they want, and what is the likelihood that they'll get it?
It's hard to determine what they want.
They want a change in the lines. We can start with that.
That's right. And I think a lot of the candidates, I think we were talking earlier, don't particularly, you know, they have a tendency to say, well, it looks like I have something I can work with. Leave me alone. So there's something beyond this. And one of the things can be to try to get the court to set up a group of masters, you know, to sort of take it away from that board, which is a warning to future boards
And the court has done that in the past.
They've done it in the past, and they changed the Constitution in 1998, so it has to bounce back and forth to the board. But when you've done it that many times, that the court could still take control.
And didn't the 98 amendment change the makeup of the board or how the board was selected? Tell us about that.
It did. Our earlier system had the governor, and it looked like it was far more political because the governor could appoint all five board members. But the thing that sort of was the honesty test, is they faced the prospect of the court almost immediately setting up a board of masters. So if you started to get, you know, a little too much, I mean, there's always been some politics there, but a little too much gerrymandering, the court was going to snatch it, and you lost control. Now, you have to be a politician to consider you don't want to lose control.
Yeah, I think one of the things that Democrats are going to argue in this reapportionment battle is that the lines were improperly drawn, particularly in rural Alaska involving, in which Inupiat and Athabascans were in the same district and perhaps shouldn't have been.
Well,
or should have been in a less so manner.
Yeah, the existing plan that's still in effect, I mean, it was horrific for rural Alaska. Like, our poorest area in the lower Yukon was hooked with Fairbanks. And the Fairbanks rep won that election. But just before that was adopted, there was money placed in the lower Yukon in the capital budget. And it was during the final days. Suddenly that area was left with no representation.
And we have, unfortunately, Mike Bredner, we have no representation either because we're out of time. Thank you for joining us on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.